I'm Hopeton Hay, and welcome to Black Perspectives, the working title of my new monthly podcast on critical issues and history in the Black community. In this inaugural episode, we feature an interview with Howard French, author of Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1461 to the Second World War. Traversing 600 years, Born in Blackness retells the story of medieval and emerging Africa, demonstrating how the economic ascendancy of Europe, the anchoring of democracy in America, and the fulfillment of so-called Enlightenment ideals all grew out of Europe's dehumanizing engagement with the darkest continent. In discussing his motivations for writing the book, one of the key points French made was that the education system has cut Africa out of the story of world history, and that it has cut African Americans out of the history of the African diaspora, and he wanted to reconnect African Americans to this history. Howard French is a career foreign correspondent and global affairs writer and the author of four books. He worked as a French-English translator in Abidjan, Ivory Coast in the early 1980s and taught English literature for several years at the University of Abidjan. From 1990 to 2008, he reported overseas for the New York Times as bureau chief for Central America and the Caribbean, West and Central Africa, Japan and the Koreas, and China. Howard, I really like to talk about the author's personal background, especially as it relates to the story that's being told in terms of the history, Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that your family moved to West Africa, I believe, when you were in college. And so talk a little bit about how that experience of having your family move to West Africa play whatever role it did play in ultimately you writing two books that are centered in Africa.
Sure. First of all, this is the third book that's centered in Africa.
There we go.
Yeah. One book is kind of dual purposed. It's about China and
right, Africa, the China
the relationship
Africa,
between right. them. But there's a my very first book is in
2004.
A right. Continent for the Taking is entirely about Africa. My parents moved with my younger siblings to West Africa, to a country called Ivory Coast, just as I was entering college in the U.S. And this was, you know, I didn't live with them there, but visited during the major holidays. And this was just a kind of intellectual awakening for me and just an explosion in terms of my experience of the world and you know, it reached me at a very deep place and changed everything, basically. After I finished school, I moved to West Africa. I lived there independently. My parents moved back with the family I stayed on. For the next several years, I discovered myself as a journalist during this time. I did a variety of other jobs as well, but began to write and in a journalistic vein and discovered a love for that. And it kind of this gathered momentum of its own and took off and led to a career in newspaper journalism, first as a freelancer in West Africa, traveling around quite a bit, writing for lots of different outlets, and then subsequently being hired by the New York Times. And I worked for that newspaper for 22 years, almost all of which was spent overseas in the Caribbean and Latin America in the first instance, then back in West and Central Africa, then in Japan, and finally in China.
So at what point as a journalist did you really start to dig deep and try to get a historical perspective of the different countries you were covering?
You know, I think to be a good journalist involved certainly in international coverage or what's sometimes called foreign correspondence. That's a basic part of the job. To do that job well, you have to not only want to read about what we call actuality, things that are taking place in the moment, but you have to know, have to have some grasp of the background of the country and of the region and of international relations around the region, et cetera, et cetera. But correspondence was a wonderful experience for me. And journalism, I think, is a fantastic career. But everything has its limitations. The limitation that I faced most in that line of work was every week or two, you have to be flying off to a different place. And if you're covering a big region, as I was covering Latin America and the Caribbean at one point, or covering West and Central Africa, this means you know, a couple dozen countries. And each of those countries has its own history. And there are some common elements, of course, but it's really at that kind of rhythm, jumping around every week or two to a different place, it's hard to get very deep. And so, you know, I was aware of this limitation at the time. And as I matured and gained an experience, I was sort of collecting notes somehow in the background of my mind about what tied these various experiences together, what tied the West Indies, for example, together with West Africa, what tied Latin America together, especially the northern part of Latin America plus Brazil together with the places I've just mentioned. As an African American, what tied the American South, the Virginia of my mother's family, or the Mississippi Valley, to these broader currents of history that I was encountering in places like West Africa or the Caribbean.
So I always think as a journalist, when you decide to do what I call the deep dive in history, because I understand that to do a good job as a journalist, you have to have some sort of background. But when you start doing the deep dive of history, I think there's really a unique perspective as a journalist because you've visited and have been working in so many of those countries covering the current events that you have a really unique perspective when you do the deep dive in history, because doesn't that affect how you interpret that history when you look at giving you a better understanding, an aha moment when you say, now I really understand this whole Haiti history thing, for example. I'll just give you one quick example. I remember reading about the decision when Napoleon was trying to resecure Louisiana. He sends troops to put down a rebellion in Haiti, and he fails. And because he fails in Haiti, he then makes a decision to sell Louisiana to the United States. And for me, that was an aha moment. So talk a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, one of my deepest frustrations as an American and also as an African American is with American exceptionalism. Americans think of themselves, I think, reflexively as having a history that is for the most part self-contained. And in fact, there are few instances anywhere in the world of histories that are self-contained. Everybody's history is deeply conditioned by the histories of other peoples with whom they have interacted or with whom they truck or commerce or from whom they gained independence or with, et cetera, right? And so you've just given one of the most powerful examples of this. Haiti, which was the richest colony in the world, in the history of mankind, in fact, in the 19th century, was the culmination of an incredible but horrible invention. And the invention was the tropical commodity plantation. And this invention was perfected in a little tiny place. I tell this entire story in Born in Blackness. This invention was perfected in the early 1500s in a little tiny place that most people never even heard of, called Sao Tome, a couple of islands off of the coast of Central Africa. And I say plantation, but plantation is a euphemism. Plantation really means prison labor complex, where torture and violence are used to extract work from slaves. And this system was put in place and perfected by the Portuguese on an island that was initially uninhabited off of Africa called Sao Tome, and slaves were brought from the mainland. And sugar was grown, and sugar was an extremely lucrative and rare commodity at the time. Ordinary Europeans could not afford to buy your refined sugar. And so the Portuguese made an enormous fortune from this right away. And then by happenstance, just a couple of years after they did this, they quote unquote discovered Brazil. And so the Portuguese take over Brazil, and Brazil is at the same latitude as Sao Tome. It has the same equatorial rain patterns and just the bio, the climate that is propitious to the growing of sugar, and enormous territory, of course. Sao Tome is tiny, Brazil is huge. So you see the chain of sugar, as I recounted in my book, go from Sao Tome, where the plantation model is put into place, across to Brazil, and then up the chain of the Caribbean. The English are next in Barbados in the 1630s. They colonize Barbados. They bring African slaves. They bring slaves from Brazil who knew, they acquired slaves from the Portuguese in Brazil who knew how to grow sugar. and they start put them to work in creating a slave sugar industry in Barbados. Barbados, a little tiny place, 1/8 the size of Long Island here in New York, 1/3 the size of the city of Los Angeles. Barbados produced more wealth for the British than all of the gold and silver that the Spanish so famously took from the Americas. You know, we hear these stories of Spanish conquistadors and the galleons, these giant ships that they filled with gold and silver. England made more money from African-produced sugar in little tiny Barbados than all of that. Okay, so your question was about Haiti. This sugar production model using plantations or prison labor camps moves up the Caribbean, finally gets to Hispaniola, the island where Haiti is located. France, in a very short period of time, in the 18th century, builds the richest colony in the history of the world, growing mostly sugar, but also coffee and tobacco and cocoa. Toward the end of the 18th century, the enslaved people rise up under a man named Toussaint Louverture, and he forms armies of Africans. And I'm saying Africans for deliberate reason. These are not Haitians. These are not New World people. These are people who were brought from Africa during their lifetimes. They're not the children of Africans. They are Africans because the death toll was such on sugar plantations in the Caribbean that the average lifespan was between 5 and 7 years. So if you're an adult working on a sugar plantation in Haiti, or it was still Hispaniola, you're from Africa directly, right? Your childhood was in Africa. Toussaint Louverture raises armies of these people, and they throw off the enslavement of three of the three greatest empires in modern world history in succession: Spain, England, and France. And when they defeat France and England had sent their largest armadas ever to any point in the world to try to defeat the slaves, and these Africans won. And when the Toussaint Louverture and his African armies defeated the French, Napoleon had spent so much money trying to hold on to this lucrative system of plantation labor that he was forced to sell the Louisiana Purchase to the Thomas Jefferson administration. Louisiana Purchase is most of the American Midwest and all of the Mississippi Valley. And this is where America's birth as a continental power takes place. It's a result of the victory of African people in what became Haiti and the movement of American, meaning continental slavery, out of the Old South, where the landlords in Virginia and Georgia and South Carolina and places like that had seen the Haitians defeat the French, the English, and the Spanish. They got worried. They're thinking, oh no, these Black people may overthrow slavery here. Let's figure out a place to send the Black people, dilute their presence in the Old South. And so Thomas Jefferson and his peers begin this vast sale of Africans on into the Mississippi Valley, where the cotton industry is created. And cotton becomes the next great measure in the creation of wealth in the Western world. Cotton becomes the ingredient sine qua non of the Industrial Revolution. We talk about British people as having had this great ingenuity, which enabled them to automate the creation through textile mills of cloth and things like that. They could not have done that without the labor, the sweat, and the blood of Africans or the descendants of Africans, who by virtue of the defeat of the French in Haiti were moved out of the Old South into the Mississippi Valley.
Wow. Let me say this, that one of the most important things about your books, there are lots of different history books that talk about Black history and African history. The importance I see in your book is where you say that you bring to light the importance of Africa, as you write, in the birth of the modern world. And that story really needs to be told on a school level. Because when I went to school, as you write in the book, we all thought about Columbus and trying to get to the Indies and the silk and the spices. The narrative did not focus on the role of the navigators trying to get to the gold in West Africa, or the trip of the Mali emperor his pilgrimage to Mecca. Those stories were not being told. Talk about the importance of this story, because I want the audience to understand the importance of not just them, but their children understand the centrality of Africa and the birth of the modern world.
Sure. So the most important priority that I had in constructing this story, which is based on extensive decade-long research into all of this history, is making reconnections. And in the first instance, because I'm an American writing a book published by an American publisher that begins at least in an American marketplace, connecting Americans and especially African Americans to the history of the world. And our education system in this country has done a couple of things. One of them is, as you just mentioned, cut Africa out of the story of world history. And the second thing is cut African Americans out of the history of the African diaspora. In other words, encourage African Americans to forget or to play down any sense of common origin, roots, intellectual contributions, shared experiences, shared struggles that they may have with people of African descent in other parts of the world. You ask about where I begin my book, which is way, way back in the 14th century, which is with a pilgrimage in 1324 by a West African sovereign and emperor named Mansa Musa, who goes to Cairo and to Egypt, crossing 3,500 miles of Saharan Africa to get to the Middle East with a convoy of 60,000 people carrying 18 tons of gold on camelback with him. Mansa Musa, who many people nowadays reckon as the richest person in the history of the world, arrives in Cairo and in Mecca with all of this gold, which he begins to distribute on the basis of patronage. He's a Muslim. He's going on pilgrimage to Mecca. He has given out so much gold that the price of gold in that region and into Europe crashes for the next decade. Nobody had ever seen that much gold before in one place. And so what happens over the succeeding decades is the Europeans become obsessed with how to find where this empire resides and where across the Sahara this Mali empire is based and what is the source of their gold. And the Portuguese take the lead in the early 1400s and set off a series of expeditions, naval expeditions down the West African coast. And in the year 1471, they finally reached the place that we now call Ghana, where they discovered there was so much gold that even ordinary sort of, even peasants, let's call them, were wearing gold jewelry. They figured, okay, we found the place. It was not actually the source of the Mali gold, but they didn't know that at the time. They just knew they had found an incredible mother load of gold. And so they set up this trade in gold with Ghana. And this is what I argue is the proximate, the original spark for the creation of the modern world. It is not the voyage looking for silks and spices to Asia that we so often have heard of. It's not Christopher Columbus's voyages to the Americas. In fact, this was so important to the Portuguese and to the Spanish, who were their rivals, that those two countries fought a naval war off the coast of West Africa in the 1480s in order to keep control of the gold trade with West Africa. Nobody ever studies that in school here. This is stuff that is incontrovertibly documented. Second point I'd like to make is, if we remember how much focus is placed on a kind of desperate bid to find a maritime route to Asia, we must pause to explain how is it that this gold was discovered in such quantities, by the way, that nearly a third of Portugal's entire crown revenue came from trade with Ghana. If they were trying to get to Asia, why is it that from 1471 to 1500, they didn't send any ships to Asia? Why is it that they don't begin until the 1500s actually to really try to do anything with Asia? The reason is because Africa had become so important to them. African wealth had become so vital to their own success and expansion. It is the gold of Ghana and then subsequently trade with places like Benin and Congo that fuel the takeoff of Portugal, that give it the wherewithal to resist conquest by Spain, and which send Spain out into the world seeking to match the achievements of Portugal. And this is why Spain ultimately funds the voyages of Christopher Columbus.
Talk about the importance of the constant flow of diplomats between Africa and Europe. I was interviewing Dr. Krebs, who wrote a book about the relationship between medieval Europe and Ethiopia. And that was one of the premises of her book, is that there's a tendency to present the relationship between Europe and Ethiopia as if there was no diplomatic relationship at all, and that Africa was the dark continent. But as in her book and as in your book, you even talk about Prince Henry the Navigator in 1448 making some changes in terms of what he thought needed to be done to build diplomatic relationships with Africa.
Right. So Henry the Navigator is the Portuguese figure in the first half of the 15th century who organizes these voyages down the coast looking for the gold that I just described. And he was a prince in the Aviz dynasty of Portugal. And he quickly realized a couple of things. One of them is that in the first few years, in the first decade, more than decade, actually, of this search for African gold, the Portuguese were not finding a lot of gold. Their ships were arriving in places like, I'm going to use the present day names of these countries, but arriving in Mauritania and arriving in Senegal, arriving in Guinea-Bissau, places like that, and not finding much gold. And in these initial voyages, they were trying to compensate this for this because Portugal was such a poor kingdom. It was a truly poor place. By capturing Africans on the coast through military means to sell, not in the New World, which had not been quote unquote discovered yet, but to sell them in Europe. And the Portuguese discovered quickly that although some African societies were, from their perspective, poorly organized and not possessing really robust means of self-defense, many other African societies were extremely well organized and had similar material capacities as the Portuguese and were quite capable of defending themselves against the Portuguese. And so the shift that you're describing is a shift that takes place in the middle of the 15th century, where the Portuguese decide this idea of raiding African countries is not working. It's going to cost us too many men, and it's not yielding gold either. And so let's have a diplomatic approach. Let's establish political relations with African societies that we're encountering. And this becomes the wave of the next century, century and a half. The Portuguese arrive in places like Benin, a kingdom that I've mentioned already, which had a wall as large as the Great Wall of China in present-day Nigeria. They arrive in Central Africa in a kingdom called Congo, and they establish political relations with these kingdoms, and they send ambassadors back and forth. And the African kingdoms have ambassadors in Europe in this era. In Congo, the Beninese were not interested in Christianity per se, which was one of the great obsessions of the Portuguese, but the Congolese were, because there were similarities between the indigenous religion on the surface and Christianity. The Congolese, for example, prior to the arrival of the Europeans, were already using the cross. Now they were not talking about Jesus, but they used the cross. And so when the Portuguese showed up with a cross, they said, oh, there's something here. There's a basis for understanding each other. And so the Congolese very quickly convert to Catholicism and have bishops named by the Vatican. In fact, one Congolese bishop was buried in the Vatican. That's how highly the Congolese were respected. Anyway, the point here is that in the contemporaneous literature of the 15th and 16th century, the thing that stands out is not African primitivism, it's African capacity. The Portuguese who are writing in this era and other Europeans who are writing in this era are marveling at the ability of Africans to construct admirable cities, to have societies that functioned in a highly elaborate way, to defend themselves, to adopt or to be conversant in European law and philosophy and things like this. And I just want to make one more point. A lot of my book is about erasure. My book is actually a brick thrown into the window of erasure of history. And I want to leave a message with the readers about why the erasure is so important. The erasure is all about atrocity. If you have an atrocity over the course of centuries, which kills and enslaves tens of millions of people, you have to do something to assuage the guilt that attaches to that atrocity. And the strategy that came to be implemented by Europeans and by Americans, meaning the dominant society in America, in British America and the United States that succeeded, it was pretending that Africa was an empty space, a place of no cultural or economic interest when the Europeans arrived. And you even see literal extrapolations of this, where people from Europe and from the United States make the argument that because they are sharing or imposing Christianity on enslaved peoples, then this makes up for any of the violence or the trouble, if you will, that has been imposed on these poor savages. And this is the whole, I'm using savage advisedly. The whole idea was, we Europeans found savages in these places. Yes, we did some terrible things to them, but in the long run, it's good because we gave them access to God.
Well, you talk about the difference between slavery and chattel slavery, and I think it's very important to make that distinction, because one of the arguments that often comes up is, well, Africans were selling slaves, they had slavery in Africa, but there was a difference between the slavery in Africa and the chattel slavery that came to be developed on the American plantation and I guess on the sugar plantation. Talk about the difference between those types of slavery.
Sure. The first thing that needs to be said is that slavery is an institution. It is a social phenomenon that has existed in every part of the world in across history. There are no exceptions. Slavery, what had only recently begun to go out of fashion in Europe at the time when Europeans discovered Africa as a reservoir for enslavement. So that's point number one. Point number two is that slavery has been different across time in different places. In Africa, slavery was characteristically and very broadly an institution of assimilation. In other words, like other parts of the world, there were constant wars between one kingdom and another, or one region and another. And the practice in Africa that was highly prevalent and almost universal was that the defeated peoples were then captured and reabsorbed into the victorious society. And this reabsorption was nearly total. The children of slaves, first of all, were not slaves. Slave women, typically females among the enslaved, very quickly married into the victorious society and did so without any persistent social taint or negative connotation. And enslaved people, once their family lines had been absorbed into the winning side, the descendants of those family lines very, very often, this is seen in one place after another in West and Central Africa, become members of the ruling class. They become chiefs. They become kings in Mali, which we have spoken about earlier. They even become an emperor. So when the Africans begin to trade for in enslaved people with the Europeans, there's a kind of a mismatch in understanding between Africans and Europeans about what this is all about. First of all, Africans didn't have a unified, synthetic, kind of holistic view about what it meant to be African. Everybody was African up until that point. All Africans were used to seeing were other Africans. So you were either a member of a given society or you were foreign to that society. It was not a matter of you're an African like I'm an African. That's point number one. Point number two, the Africans had never seen a form of slavery that was one of perpetual enslavement, which is what chattel slavery is. Chattel slavery, which the Europeans invent in Sao Tome and then extend all the way across the Atlantic to Brazil and up the Caribbean and into the American South, as we've just discussed, is a slavery where people have no rights, first of all. Their families are broken. Their children become enslaved on and on into perpetuity. Africans had never seen or imagined an institution like this. So they're selling people into enslavement, not knowing any of this. I'm not trying to prettify it. But there were no Africans who went to the New World and saw what the Europeans were up to and were able to come back and say, hey, everybody in Africa, we Africans, we need to unite and be aware of this. There was no awareness. There was no possibility of awareness of this. So you have a fundamental conflict in understanding the terms of enslavement between Africans and Europeans. And this, unfortunately, allowed Africans to certain African societies to profit longer through the participation in selling people into the market of human beings than they might have otherwise.
I want to talk a little bit about the importance of sugar. And you write that by the middle of the 18th century, sugar and the various products made from it, from molasses to rum, had laid the foundations of mass consumerism and utterly transformed eating habits in Europe. Talk about the importance of sugar to the urbanization and the development of capitalism in Europe.
Sure, that's a great question. So when sugar starts to enter into the European markets in quantities sufficient to reach ordinary people, which begins to happen very late in the 1500s and early in the 1600s, a number of extraordinarily important things begin to happen. Of course, this is the era of, that we in European and world history is often talked about of as the Enlightenment. And I want to explain to you how Africa and the labor of Africans actually played a central role in this supposed Enlightenment. So first of all, sugar, although dietitians and health buffs today think of sugar as mostly a bad thing, in a Europe of that era, when living standards were so radically lower than they are now, the availability of cheap sugar was a source of energy in the diet of Europeans that had profound effects. People were able to work much longer days. European productivity through these cheap calories increased vastly. And then a couple of other things happen that are really important. Sugar was the main crop, but alongside sugar was the crop of coffee. Coffee was also grown by slaves in the Caribbean and in Brazil. And so these two things enter European markets at roughly the same time. And in 1650, the first coffee shop opens in Oxford, the home of Oxford, the famous university. And it becomes an overnight phenomenon, and coffee houses spread throughout England very, very quickly. And most importantly to London, where a number of them get set up. And the coffee houses, of course, there people are drinking coffee, but they're drinking coffee sweetened and made palatable by the availability of cheap sugar. And so two things are happening. One of them is the drinking of coffee during the day allowed Europeans not to be drunk at work because ale, sanitary water supplies were non-existent in Europe at the time. And so in the workplace, in addition to having not enough calories, English people drank ale because it was the only healthy thing that one could be sure not to get sick from in terms of gastrointestinal problems if one drank it during the daytime. And so this was another incredibly limiting factor of productivity among Europeans. But back to the coffee. The coffee shops spread in London after 1650, and some clever entrepreneur gets the idea, seeing how stimulated people are from drinking coffee infused with sugar in coffee shops, they think they have a captive market for a new product called the newspaper. And so they begin to sell. They don't look like a modern newspaper in that moment. They look like single sheets or a few sheets stapled together. And they sell them to these sort of captive audiences of people enlivened by the coffee, who are often smoking tobacco and other slave products, sitting for long hours in coffee shops. And the newspaper is an extraordinarily central innovation in terms of the Enlightenment and the spread of democracy in Europe, because it allows for the first time the birth of a sense among people that the affairs of the state, the affairs of the government, the political affairs of the day are things of ordinary concern to everyday concern to ordinary people. And so this is in the 1650s, 60s, and 70s, another moment when the contribution of Africans and of enslaved people and the fruits of their labor, sugar, coffee, tobacco, also cocoa, become instrumental in changing Europe in ways that have not been recognized.
I do want to go back to Africa, and specifically, you talked in the book about the Songhai Empire, which I believe succeeded the Mali Empire as a great trading empire in West Africa, and how the defeat of the Songhai Empire sort of led to the political fragmentation of Africa, which made it easier for slavery to take off.
Yes. So the Songhai was, as you said, the successor empire to the Mali Empire. This region of West Africa, which is mostly contained in the country, modern day country called Mali, was the site of a series of great empires, starting with the Ghana Empire, whose roots go back to the 6th century, and then the Mali Empire, which was the home to this person, Mansa Musa, the richest person in history that we discussed at the outset. And the Mali Empire was succeeded by an even more extensive empire, meaning more surface area, the Songhai Empire. And so the Songhai Empire gets defeated at the end of the 1500s by an invasion from North Africa, from an empire, a Muslim empire based in present-day Morocco. And I make the argument that the defeat of the Songhai Empire, which was extraordinarily extensive, it had branches that extended into northern Nigeria through Burkina Faso, northern Ghana, the country of Niger, Senegal, Mauritania, northern Guinea. So really an incredibly large swath of West Africa. Its defeat creates a kind of political fragmentation throughout the region, right on at the very moment when the Portuguese were beginning to penetrate the region for their own purposes. It's kind of a softening up of West Africa by happenstance, by coincidence of history, at a time when, had there been a consolidated power like such as the Songhai, one can imagine a very different encounter in the 16th century between Europe and Africa. Had there been a strong consolidated political power as extensive as the Songhai, the Portuguese, who already recognized that they were not able to defeat even much smaller kingdoms along the African coast, might have continued well beyond these early encounters to privilege a kind of state-to-state relationship with Africa, as opposed to trying to siphon off people have them fight each other, which becomes, the Portuguese and their followers, the French, the English, the Dutch, they begin to pursue in the 16th century a policy of giving arms to one African group to encourage it to fight against another African group, so that the slaves that result from this warfare feed their own slave trade. Had there been a consolidated empire in West Africa in this period, one imagines there would have been much less opportunity for that kind of mischief.
I want to close with the importance of Haiti. This interview is being taped in December 2021. And with the treatment of Haitian immigrants this horrific treatment of Haitian immigrants trying to come into this country. First of all, would there even be a continental United States if it was not for the emergence of the successful slave rebellion in Haiti?
The short answer is no.
The short answer is no.
One can imagine a variety of other processes that might, over a much longer period of time, led to a continental power like the United States. But you have to remember, the French owned what the equivalent of 15 states in the Midwest, which they sold because of the Haitian victory against imperialists, right? Beyond the Midwest, owned by the French, Mexico owned most of the Southwest. Spain still owned some of the Far West, and England owned some of the Northwest. And so if it were not for the Haitians defeating the French and making Napoleon sell this extraordinarily vast territory at the center of the country, with the Mississippi River being this vital, vital course of commerce and communication and transportation throughout this entire region, It's really hard to imagine how the United States grows anytime soon into the country that it became.
Besides the fact that we have been trying to buy New Orleans for the French, to get access to New Orleans, my hometown, by the way. The second thing is, would there be an independent Latin America if was it not for the president of Haiti supporting Simón Bolívar and encouraging the freeing of slaves in Latin America?
So this is another sort of chapter in the general ignorance of the importance of Haitian history and the suppression of this narrative in terms of the telling that we all experience of the creation of the world we're familiar with. Toussaint Louverture and the other early Haitian leaders were incredible internationalists. They, as you said, played a vital role in supporting and encouraging independence in Latin America, and in particular, Simón Bolívar, who regarded Toussaint Louverture as a great hero. But they also played a really, really important and untold role in the encouragement of American freedom among African Americans. Haitian independence was celebrated, sometimes secretly, by African Americans in the pre-Civil War era. African American newspapers in Philadelphia and other places called Haitian Independence Day the true Independence Day, the day that we as African Americans all need to be celebrating. And this was not just a matter of symbolism. The Haitians entertained political and diplomatic and intellectual relations with African Americans throughout this period and beyond, including Frederick Douglass's ambassadorship eventually from the United States to Haiti.
I do want to add one last thing, because I'm a huge fan of jazz, being from New Orleans. You did visit the Clarksdale. We know the importance of Clarksdale, Mississippi, and the Delta Blues. We know the importance of jazz in New Orleans, but I'm going to put you on the spot here. I know you're totally unprepared for this question. So if you are stuck on an island and you have to bring five original albums with you, five, I'd like to say I would bring Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool, John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, the Eagles, some things like that. So what albums? And I'm expecting to hear mostly jazz and blues albums from you. You might surprise me here. What five albums would you bring?
You've put me on the spot for sure. Let me see. Okay, let's try this. I've got to bring a blues album. And so since I've talked about Muddy Waters so much in the concluding chapter of my book, I would probably choose his plantation recordings made in 1945, which are from his pre-electric era. I would probably choose, I'm a big lover of Miles Davis. I know his entire catalog very well, but I would choose an album that's not among his best known albums. I would choose an album called Big Fun, which is a late electric album that it just blows me away, and is very Africanist in its origins. The names of the songs all have African, not all, but very many, like Ife, a great kingdom in Yoruba, Nigeria, or Calypso Frelimo, a song about the liberation in Mozambique. I would choose, Jackie McLean, a saxophonist I love, an album called Destination Out. I would choose, I'm a big lover of Dexter Gordon as well, so I don't want to really cut him out. I would choose Go by Dexter Gordon. I would choose a collection of Bud Powell records. And let's see, what else? And Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix.
Oh. Oh yes, yes. That was one of my album collections. Yes, yes, indeed. I am a huge Jimi Hendrix fan. Absolutely, right. There.
Can't be left out.
Oh no, not at all. I think he's kind of being forgotten in the general public, you know, yeah. And you know, when I listen to his music, remember I played it once and my friends were complaining at a party. Why are you playing this music? I said, don't you know he played for the Isley Brothers, that electric guitar on, you know, on the Summer Breeze? I'm sure that Marvin Isley was inspired by watching Jimi Hendrix play.
Absolutely. Miles Davis was too.
Yeah, and Miles Davis, his electric phase sounds to me like lead guitar. When I listen to when he goes to the electronic phase, I listen to that almost like the similarity between sort of the lead guitar rock.
Yeah, there's a Miles in that phase had one of his electric guitarists was a guy named Pete Kosi, who was an African American and who was a devotee of Hendrix. And Miles was socially friendly with Hendrix, and they had a plan to record together, which was at Electric Ladyland Studios, which was Hendrix's studio here in Manhattan. And it never came off because that year Hendrix died in London of an overdose or of asphyxiation.
Howard French, author Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1461 to the Second World War. This is a remarkable book. I really encourage families to read this book. And I will say this, that sometimes people are afraid of 500-page books, but I look at your book like I did a book about the history of the Black intellectuals. I forgot the exact name. It's Howard Cruz's book. You know, it's just this incredible 500-page book. And the way I look at that is you don't try to read it in one city from cover to cover. You read it based on the subjects you want to get, you want to learn more about. Because I look at it as an incredible reference book to do a deep dive into specific topics, not necessarily something that, unless you're an academic, that you're going to sit down. So I think this is something that people really should have in their library.
Hey, thank you very much, Hampton. I've enjoyed this tremendously. And just on the book, I would say that, you know, I took the research and documentation extremely seriously. I wanted to write a book that historians would respect. I mean, scholarly historians. But I wrote the book in a way that was intended to be accessible. And so even though it's as long as you say it is, I think readers will find that it is in the reading experience, it is not intimidating at all. That it is told in a narrative way, and you know, it's not heavy on jargon or on theory, even though it is deeply respectful of the facts.
Oh, absolutely. And let me add that too, because I don't want to tell people it is definitely readable. It is definitely written for the public. And I do love when journalists who have that experience of current events, who have lived in all these different places or experiencing the political climates, the social climates, all these different places, do the deep dive into history on subject areas that they've been covering under current affairs. I just love that. So thank you so much, Howard French. His website is howardfrench.com
for being
wfrench.com. That journalist coming out here. Okay.
Thanks for being a guest.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you again for listening to the inaugural episode of Black Perspectives, the working title of my new podcast. I'm Hopeton Hay.